When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
As you probably know by now, Donald Trump has been acclaiming something so extreme, so far-fetched, and so absurd, you think it would have been laughed out of the court. That is, of course, Trump's arguments that presidents are immune from criminal prosecution for practically anything they may do while in office. And I literally mean anything. In fact, according to Trump's lawyers, that immunity is so broad, it allows a president to assassinate a political rival and face virtually zero consequences. That's the argument they've been making. But as ridiculous as that may be, the question of presidential immunity is now before the Supreme Court, which delayed Trump's federal trial in D.C. and is set to hear his appeal later this month. Their decision and the timing of that decision could determine whether Trump is ever held accountable for his actions on and around January 6th. Now, in a scathing, I mean scathing, I've been reading it, rebuke of the former president, special counsel Jack Smith is hitting back hard. In a filing with the Supreme Court that came down literally minutes ago, good thing I'm a fast reader, and so is Lisa Rubin and Sherrilyn Ifill, prosecutors stated that, quote, the president's constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed does not entail a general right to violate them. Smith shreds Trump's argument that criminal statutes somehow don't apply to presidents, saying, quote, that radical suggestion, which would free the president from virtually all criminal law, even crimes such as bribery, murder, treason, and sedition, is unfounded. And there's a lot more, and we're going to get into it right now, because joining me now is MSNBC legal correspondent Lisa Rubin and Sherrilyn Ifill, former president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, two brilliant female legal eagles. So grateful to be here with both of you. Lisa, I just want to start with you. I know this literally just came down minutes ago, but you're both brilliant lawyers. I'm so grateful to you both for being here. Give me your immediate reaction to this new filing from the special counsel.
You know, Jen, the thing that struck me immediately is some of the concessions that are here, because some of these arguments we've seen before, right? This is the third time that the special counsel's office is briefing this issue of presidential immunity before federal courts in this federal election interference case before Judge Chutkan. But for the first time, they are encountering a Supreme Court that could side with Donald Trump on more than one issue here, or more than one subpart of what's being decided. And so you see, starting at page 8, them make a sort of new argument that even if the court holds, and I'm reading from the brief here, that a former president is entitled to some immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts, that principle does not preclude trial on this indictment. And then they make a number of sub-arguments. They're saying the specific thing that he's been charged with here, efforts to subvert an election in violation of the term of office clause of Article 2 and the constitutional process for electing a president, is basically so serious that even if the court decides some form of immunity is necessary and justifiable for former presidents, it's not on these facts with these allegations of these crimes. But the second thing that they say is, look, if he's saying that he's entitled to immunity for official acts and you somewhat agree with him, note that most of what we're alleging here is, in fact, private conduct. This guy was acting in his capacity as a candidate. And even if he did certain things in that capacity that involved sitting in the Oval Office or the White House and taking what looks like official acts, he was really involved in a conspiracy with private actors for his own private and personal aim. So I think what you're seeing here from Jack Smith and his team are a number of different concessions designed to preserve their case, even if a majority of this court or a plurality of this court decide that former presidents are entitled to some form of presidential immunity.
Now, that's so interesting, Lisa. Thank you for breaking that down as you did. And I also, as a non-lawyer, it struck me the emphasis, as you just referenced, on kind of as a private citizen. It really goes into that, or not as acts of his official acts. Sherrilyn, I know we've talked about immunity in this case so much, but it's important to remind people, why is that differentiation important? And also, what stuck out to you in the portions of this you've been able to read?
Yeah, thanks, Jen. You know, Trump has always wanted to, he wants to be Teflon when it comes to the law. He does not want it to apply to him. And he has always had a conception of his role as the president that it somehow constitutes a lifelong immunity from accountability. And for that reason, Lisa, I think, did a great job of describing the filing today. I found this incredibly depressing. And the reason I found the filing depressing is because this is a case with no legs. This was dealt with in great detail by the Court of Appeals. This should have been summarily handled by the Supreme Court. And it is a testament to how reckless this Supreme Court has become, how unpredictable, how far out of the mainstream it has become, that the special counsel felt it was incumbent upon him to create backstops, to create secondary and tertiary positions, because he could not trust that a majority of this Supreme Court would do what every other clear, sane jurist acting not in a political context, but acting in a pure legal context would know had to be true, that our system of government was not created to ensure that one man would lack accountability, could rise to the highest level of government in our country. And that would then constitute a cloak of impunity. This is just simply not, it's at odds with the very concept of our country. That's King George. And so this should have been a slam dunk. The fact that even Jack Smith clearly is concerned that given the Supreme Court, it may not be a slam dunk made me very uneasy reading this filing.
That's such an important point. I mean, this is a thorough, this is a lengthy brief here. It's not two pages. And he had to, as you just said, Sherrilyn, really detail point by point by point here, even though experts like both of you have repeatedly said there's no basis here. I just want to dig into some of the other specific quotes here that stuck out to me, and you may have other ones, of course. Another expert from excerpt from this filing talks about precedent, as we've been talking about a little bit. Smith writes, quote, "The absence of any prosecutions of former presidents until this case does not reflect the understanding that presidents are immune from criminal liability. It instead underscores the unprecedented nature of petitioners' alleged conduct." This is a, obviously, it's written in a legal brief. I think it is a important, powerful message point that could continue to be repeated. He's facing this, despite what Sherrilyn just said about whether the Supreme Court should be arguing this or considering this case or not, because of his actions. Lisa, talk to me a little bit about that and why that was so important to include, or whether you agree that it was important to include, I guess.
It was hugely important to include, in part because, Jen, that's a principal argument on which Donald Trump has relied, that in our nation's history, we have never seen a prosecution like this. And you know that some of the superlatives that come out of his mouth or the hyperbole is ever, you know, he's very fond of speaking in never before have we seen this, or people always say, right? And one of the things that he has incorporated into his legal filings is we've never seen anything like this before. So I think it was important for the special counsel to counter that and say we haven't seen this because nobody has acted in office like you have. And to your point about this becoming an important messaging tool, I've talked a lot about how the political and the legal appear to be collapsing in Trump's various cases, that things that come out of his mouth then manifest themselves in legal argument, even though, as you and I discussed on Friday night, they seem more like an opposition research document than a legal brief. Now I think you're seeing the flip side of that, which is that Jack Smith, in his quest to defend what should be easy for everybody to understand, somebody allegedly broke the law and in a big way and is being called to account for that, even though that person was formerly the president of the United States, Jack Smith, in his legal filing, is now saying things that should and can be persuasive to the American people in taking back their power with respect to voting in November's election.
Now, today was Jack Smith. Oh, I was going to just say, Sherrilyn, go ahead. Go ahead if you wanted to add to what Lisa had to say.
Well, I did, because, you know, the flip side of that is that these kinds of arguments are also ones we're now hearing. If we're saying that Trump is making arguments that you would expect from Oppo Research and they're winding up in legal briefs, they're also winding up in judicial decisions. And we're hearing it from courts. And the reason why Trump is making that argument that never before has this happened before is because it was just effective in the Section 3 case where the Supreme Court, the majority opinion, was saying, you know, have we ever seen a state try to keep a federal officer from the ballot? The idea that we are facing this unprecedented since the Civil War challenge to democracy in this country is being used as evidence that we can't challenge this challenge. And I actually, when I read that, I read that as having again to confront what has been Trump's argument, but what we also have heard from the Supreme Court in their kind of incredulity that we've never seen this before. Well, thank goodness we don't regularly see insurrections. Thank goodness we don't regularly have presidents engaging in criminal conduct for which they might be subject to prosecution after they leave office. All of this is uncharted territory, and that is irrelevant to the question of whether or not he has immunity. So I think just even fooling around with that notion that, like, because it's unprecedented, it means something significant is a way that Trump does the most outrageous things that no one could have imagined the president doing, and then raises the fact that no one could have imagined a president doing it as a defense. And I think that's part of why Jack Smith is referencing that, because that seems to resonate certainly with the Supreme Court in the Section 3 case and might again.
It's such an, Sherilyn, you do such an effective job every time we talk about bringing us back down to planet Earth on what's happening with the Supreme Court.
I'm a Debbie Downer, I'm sorry.
I know, Debbie Downer, straight talker, return us to planet. We need to be aware of things, all super important. Let me ask you, Lisa, about, because there's a lot of history in here. I mean, he talks about Nixon quite a bit and the precedent, how that's not a precedent, and things. He also talks about what the framers intended. He points out the framers provide no support for the kind of immunity Trump is claiming. How is that argument? I mean, you'd think, as a sane person, that argument would be effective with the conservative justices, but I know Sherilyn's going to tell me not to be naive. So how do you think that argument will play with the conservative justices, that this is not what the framers intended? How likely is that going to be something we hear?
Well, look, I agree with Sherilyn completely that this is a court that fetishizes history, and that the absence of history was one way in which they justified what textually was an unjustifiable result in the Section 3 case. The provision of the Constitution that was at issue there interpretively should have led to a different result. And yet the court knew what result they wanted to reach, and they reached out and grabbed that absence of history to get there. That having been said, to the extent that there's a counterpunch to that absence of history, it's this framers argument, because this is a court that also fetishizes originalism. And so to the extent that they can bring the court back not only to what is our political history, but what is the history of this document and at its founding, I think that is hopefully going to be successful with these folks in getting them to see that there is no basis in our constitutional text or otherwise to immunize this person. The absence of history here is one supporting his interpretation as much as anything else.
Now, despite the absence of any relevant or any justification in our constitutional text, Sherilyn, bring us back down to earth. Is this something will this be appealing to the conservative justices? This is not what the framers intended, or what do you think? What should we prepare for?
Well, this time I think Lisa I'm a bit persuaded by what Lisa has said, because this Supreme Court is quite interested in the framers of the original Constitution. They're not interested in the intention of the framers of the 14th Amendment, but certainly of the original Constitution. I don't know how you get past Article 1, Section 3, which makes clear that if Trump had been convicted during that impeachment, he could still have been prosecuted after he left office. Like, what would be the purpose of that section in the Constitution if merely because he was impeached but not convicted, he now could not be convicted or tried in a criminal prosecution? So I think it just makes that provision of the Constitution illogical. And I think that is something that would concern these justices. I do think, and I've said this before, you know, I think we raised the Nixon scenario because for most of us, that's the scenario that comes closest in terms of a president running afoul of the law and abusing power in this way. But I've said before, you know, many of these people, including many conservative justices on the court, are people who really believe that Nixon got a raw deal. And so to the extent, you know, Nixon is a precedent, I'm not sure it's a precedent that they like in terms of the way it turned out, because I do think one of the most powerful precedents is that Nixon accepted the pardon. You don't accept a pardon unless you are essentially saying that you were guilty of something. And so, you know, to me, that's kind of makes it open and shut. And yet I'm betting that there are lots of folks around who feel like Nixon was railroaded into accepting a pardon. And so I just think that we're going to find out quite a bit about this case. But I felt myself very worried by the filing today and by the clear-eyed realization that Jack Smith understands we're working with a very, very tricky majority on the Supreme Court, and nothing can be assumed.
Such an important reminder. We have to sneak in a very quick break. Lisa Rubin, thank you so much for being here, for quick reading, for breaking it down. Sherilyn, thank you for sticking around for one more block, if you still can. Because as we digest Jack Smith's filing, a long list of military leaders are siding with the special counsel and speaking out forcefully against the former president. Former Armor Secretary Luis Caldera signed that remarkable brief we saw today. He's standing by and joins me in just 60 seconds.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
As we all digest Jack Smith's brief to the Supreme Court on presidential immunity, thanks in part to Lisa Rubin and Sherilyn Ifill for explaining it to us, we also heard today from a group of high-ranking former military officials who issued a dire warning in an amicus brief filed with the court. Those officials include retired four-star generals and admirals, as well as former secretaries of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, who served this country, and this is an important part, under presidents of both parties, from John F. Kennedy up to Donald Trump himself. Together, they argue that presidential immunity from criminal prosecution would threaten the military's role in American society, our nation's constitutional order, and our national security. They say that immunizing the president would place service members in the impossible position of having to choose between following their commander-in-chief and obeying the laws enacted by Congress. And they warn it would jeopardize America's standing as a guardian of democracy in the world and feed the spread of authoritarianism. It's a very powerfully written document. And joining me now, former Secretary of the Army, Luis Caldera, who is the chief signatory on that amicus brief. Sherilyn Ifill is back with us as well. And Secretary Caldera, thank you so much for taking the time this evening. This is a very powerful brief. It's a very powerful argument. I tried to touch on some of the key points there, but tell us a little bit more about how you decided to sign on to your the chief signatory and what you hope people will take away.
Well, we thought it was very important to bring these national security issues to the Supreme Court's attention. These are very learned individuals, but none of them have ever served in the military. So when you talk about things like civilian control of the military, the importance of civil-military relations, how immunity of a president for criminal actions, immunity meaning that he could not be charged or prosecuted for criminal actions, how that would seriously threaten our national security. Because, for example, as you mentioned, the way the president would accomplish any of these goals, whether it was to assassinate a political rival or to use uniformed military soldiers against demonstrators that he disagreed with on our streets, mm-hmm. something that is outlawed in the United States by the Posse Comitatus Act, the way he would do it is he wouldn't do it directly. He would order the military to use its might, its soldiers, its weapons in a way that was unlawful, whether on U.S. soil or against or in some other way. And when he transmits those orders, he transmits them through civilian appointees, the Secretary of Defense, the service secretaries, to the military, to the Chief of Staff of the Army, the Commander-in-Chief of the Joint Chiefs, down to the individual service member. All of those individuals swore an oath to defend the Constitution, to follow the orders of the president and those appointed over them, and to obey the law. And there's a thing called the duty to disobey, which means that you only have a duty to obey lawful orders. You have no duty. In fact, you have a duty not to obey unlawful orders. And this goes back to World War II and Nazi Germany, when saying that you were just following orders became untenable as a defense. It is not recognized. You cannot just say, I was just following orders. So a president who is intent on violating the law because he's not subject to criminal prosecution would put the military officers and soldiers, the troops, in a position to do things that are unlawful for which they could be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. So that's a terrible dilemma to put service members in. And who would transmit those orders? It would be his political appointees, who would either have to decide to resign because they couldn't pass on unlawful orders, or if they're so loyal to him, they would pass them on. And then it would be the generals who would have to either resign or transmit them or pass them on. That will destroy the relationships between our senior civilian appointed officials and the military leaders. The military leaders are career military leaders who've dedicated their lives to preserving our country. They are not politicians. Mm-hmm. The appointees are appointed political leaders. And the only way that civilian and military leadership works together is if there's fundamental trust between the civilian and military leaders, that we're all on the same page, that we're all trying to defend the country, defend the Constitution, obey the rule of law, do what's in the best interest of the country. But if you have a president whose intent to use the military for unlawful purposes, you've destroyed that unity that exists. You've destroyed that trust. You've created chaos in the ranks. You've put soldiers in an untenable position, created an incredible dilemma for them. You've probably misused the military in a way that average Americans are going to say, wait, our military is being used for political purposes. It will undermine support for the military. And it sends the wrong message to other countries in this world where our country is the vanguard of democracy. One of the things we actually try to teach in the military is to communicate to militaries and governments in other parts of the world that democracy is the best way to have stability and peace, where the people have a voice, where you follow the rule of law. And instead, it would set the example that that our democracy doesn't actually function because we have a president who has the kind of authority that Kim Jong-il has in North Korea, where he can do whatever he wishes and he is completely and totally immune from any accountability.
Secretary, that was such a well-stated, important message for people to hear out there, and I am so grateful you shared it and also wrote this brief. I want to ask you, Sherilyn, I mean, and I asked you to stay because I think it's so important for people to know, as such a respected legal expert as you are, why this is significant. I mean, the secretary just broke down the impact, which is dramatic, on the chain of command, on men and women serving our country in the military, on how other countries see us. You summarized it better than I just did, but why is this important legally? Why is this a big deal in your view?
You know, first of all, I want to thank Secretary Caldera not only for this brief, but also for just the very, very powerful way you just explained what was important about it. Donald Trump has two ways that he is able to hold on to power. One is he undermines and unravels the rule of law. And the other is that he weakens and unravels core democratic institutions. The military is such an institution. You just heard the values and the laws and the rules and the ethical guidelines that govern the conduct of those who enter the military. And it is so powerful and important for the Supreme Court to understand that what feels for Trump, you know, Trump is drowning, and a drowning man will often drown others with them. He is grasping and he wants this cloak of immunity. And he is unconcerned about the fact that he will unravel the integrity of the military should he prevail in his argument. Remember also that Trump has very little respect for those in the military. These are the people he calls suckers and losers. These are the people who he feels if they are injured, he doesn't want them in parades or to be seen near him because it makes him look bad. So he doesn't have a lot of respect for the military. The second thing he doesn't have respect for is the rule of law. And I think what Secretary Caldera described is precisely what is happening in the civilian population. Mm-hmm. The more people believe that the president has impunity, can get away with anything, the less they believe that we really are a country that holds dear the rule of law. And once people stop believing that the rule of law is important, that there must be accountability for violations of law, that no one is above the law, the more that becomes inculcated in the American mind, the more we are going to have lawless and dangerous conduct. And in the context of the military, that is particularly disturbing. It was Donald Trump, you'll remember, who pardoned a Navy SEAL who had engaged in conduct for which he had been court-martialed. He made a hero of one of these individuals that he pardoned, who by his had been reported by his own fellow officers, and Trump pardoned him. So he is an unraveler of institutions, an unraveler of the rule of law, and the Supreme Court needed and needs to hear from these military leaders to explain what the effect of Trump's argument would be on the military, a core and critical institution of our democracy.
Secretary Caldera, Sherrilyn Ifill, what a powerful, powerful conversation and discussion. I really appreciate you both joining me this evening. And coming up next, Donald Trump posted a lengthy video this morning touting his stance on abortion. But it's not, it's what he did not say. That's what should give voters pause. I'll break it down after the quick break.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Okay, so former President Donald Trump put out a statement this morning on abortion. I very specifically said statement there, though even that word might be generous in describing his word salad he put out this morning, because despite some headlines that may be suggesting otherwise, it was definitely not a clarification or an announcement of his position on abortion rights at all. I mean, he said lots of things, and he also said basically nothing. Now, some, including the leader of an anti-choice group, heard it as a rebuke of all her efforts to roll back women's rights, saying in part, quote, "We are deeply disappointed in President Trump's position. Unborn children and their mothers deserve national protections and national advocacy from the brutality of the abortion industry." I mean, it's pretty strong words, I suppose, from an anti-choice leader against Donald Trump. But before we start painting Donald Trump, the guy who once said there should be some sort of punishment for women who get abortions, and who is responsible, I think it's important to remind everyone, for nominating three of the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe as anywhere near moderate on this issue, reading that statement he issued this morning as moderate is completely the wrong read. Listen to what he's actually saying here.
"The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state. Now it's up to the states to do the right thing."
So he says he wants to leave it up to the states. Let's just dive into what that really means. It means too bad for the women in more than 20 states facing bans or significant restrictions early in pregnancy. The states decide for you. It means that for women in Florida who will soon live under a six-week abortion ban, it's before most people know they're pregnant, they're just going to have to deal with it. It means under a Trump administration, we will likely hear more stories like that of Kate Cox, who found out when she was pregnant that her baby had a fatal diagnosis. And when she tried to terminate the pregnancy to save her own life, the Texas court said no, forcing her to leave the state to get the procedure. Or stories like Amanda Zaroski, who could not get medical care because of her state's abortion laws, causing her to develop sepsis and nearly die. That is what leaving it up to the states means, just to be totally clear. And while Donald Trump desperately tried to avoid taking a position here today, dodging the questions, essentially just restating where the law currently stands, what may be most revealing is what he did not say. He did not say how he would treat mifepristone, the abortion pill facing a legal fight. He did not say how many weeks he believes is appropriate to ban abortion. And crucially, he did not say whether or not he would sign a national abortion ban if one makes it to his desk. Let's be clear. Not addressing a national abortion ban does not mean he would not sign one. If he puts out a statement saying, I won't sign a national abortion ban, by all means, the headline should say that. But that's not what he did. So Trump might have talked a lot in this video. He's put out a lot of statements today, saying a lot of words, but he really offered very little. I mean, no new information, no specifics, no answers on the most pressing questions. Thing is, he is intentionally muddying the waters because he knows this is a losing issue for him. I mean, he reads the polls. He's right on that front. But it's also pretty interesting, bold even, given this is a mess that he himself created. Now, let's go back history a little bit. In 1999, he was pro-choice. Listen to this clip we dug up of Trump in his own words, just in 1999.
I thought I would read a statement because so many people have been asking my views on it. And that is the following. I am pro-choice, but I respect the views of those who are not. I believe that this is a very personal decision that must be left to women and their doctors, not to the politicians.
So that was 1999. Then in 2011, when he was mulling a run for the White House and it was politically advantageous for him, he was pro-life. In 2016, he decided to out-pro-life the rest of the field, and he ran on a pledge to appoint pro-life justices to the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. And of course, over the course of his presidency, he then nominated three of the justices to the Supreme Court who did overturn Roe. And he's bragged about his role in that. So here's the thing. No one should be tricked by his word salad statements. To him, he could care less about women's rights or freedoms. That's pretty clear. He's also, his guiding principle on this issue is political expediency. That's also clear. I mean, he even literally admitted as much in his announcement today, saying, quote, you must follow your heart on this issue, but remember, you must also win elections. Winning. That's all this is and has ever been about for Donald Trump. I can understand why. Even when you look at a state like Ohio, one that has been trending red in recent years, voters resoundingly, 57%, passed a constitutional amendment protecting abortion access just last year. So let's call this what it is. Your health care and that of your daughter, your granddaughter, your sister, your wife, your neighbor, it's all political games for Trump. And last time he had the chance, when he was president, he didn't protect those rights. He paved the way for having them taken away. Senator Sherrod Brown is standing by, and he joins me next. We'll be right back. When it comes to how the issue of abortion might affect down-ballot races, few people understand what's at stake quite like my next guest. Joining me now is Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who is up for re-election this year. Senator, thank you so much for taking the time. It's quite a news day. We had a quite a word salad, abortion statement, legal news, and eclipse. So let me just start with Trump's statement on abortion this morning. What did you make of it when you read it?
I pretty much made of it what you just said, that they, you know, that across the country, and I will not talk about across the country, I'll talk about my opponent. There are three Republicans in the primary for the Senate in Ohio, all of them backed a national abortion ban. The winner of the primary, Trump's guy, is for a six-week ban. No exceptions, a national abortion ban, 6 weeks. They're dancing about it now, but in the end, it's whom do you trust? Do you trust women and their families and their physicians, or do you trust Columbus politicians, or for a national ban, do you trust Washington politicians? And that's clear. That's why Ohio, a state that, you know, a lot of you in the national media like to say is trending conservative, overwhelming 14 points, almost 14 points, 57-43, said no. In places that we wouldn't have expected, communities that we wouldn't have expected, but mm-hmm. women spoke out and spoke out, and we won on it.
Yeah, it's such an important point. And I will say my husband's from Ohio. I've been to Ohio many, many times, so I know it well. But, you know, as you said, it's an issue that is really trending among women, independents, among men as well, as is one they're concerned about. And that abortion constitutional amendment last year, 57% of Ohioans supported it, which I think is a pretty big number. Did that surprise you, the size of that? And how important is this as an issue in your race against your opponent, who's a very extreme position on abortion, as you just referenced?
Yeah, I thought we were going to win. I mean, all the political people in Columbus, the governor, all the state office holders, the Secretary of State put his thumb on the scale, changed the ballot language, tried to require 60. With all of that, we still won by 14 points, which tells it the turnout was expected because it was the middle of August for the first vote, expected to be, Secretary of State said, 8, 9, 10 points. It was 14. Too much political minutia. But the fact is that they did all kinds of things to try to defeat this. Voters still said yes to a constitutional amendment of abortion rights. And Republicans in Ohio, they don't quite know what to do. They know they're on the wrong side. But think of the arrogance here. Even though the voters said by 14 points, no, the constitutional amendment on abortion, on abortion rights, there's still the arrogance of still trying to stop it, using the courts, calling a national abortion ban, which would override it. All those things are doing shows such a disregard for the voters of the state. And that spills into the whole election, because my opponent has that arrogance in a whole host of issues. And if you are that much against women's rights and that much against women and their families making these personal decisions, it usually means you're wrong on civil rights. It means you're wrong on human rights and worker rights. And my opponent's against the minimum wage. I mean, you can just line up all the issues that matter to most people in my state. And as you know, Jen, I don't look at politics left or right. I look at it as whose side you're on. Mm-hmm. And that's why I know this election is going to go in the right way, because on, you know, whether it's standing up to the drug companies or Wall Street or the oil companies or the railroads in East Palestine where they had the derailment, voters don't think of liberal conservative. They think of whose side are you on.
No question about it. Your neighbors don't talk about things in the way that people talk about them in Washington, D.C. Let me ask you, because you've been reelected, of course, twice already in Ohio. You're popular in the state. It has been trending red, as you said, in presidential races, right? And so people question, can a Democrat win the Senate race? Tim Ryan ran a good race, still lost by 7 points. Break down for me. How can you win this race, and how are you going to defeat your opponent?
Of course you can. Now, let me give you a real quick story. I spoke, there's a group in the building trades around Ohio, understand they've got to get much larger. They've got to bring more women in, more people of color. And they're doing that. They did this certification graduation I spoke to in Columbus a few weeks ago. And mostly were young people that are looking for an opportunity. They took this class. They will be ready at the end of their 13-week certification to be certified to join the building trades. They will get an apprentice card, apprentice carpenter or electrician or pipe fitter or bricklayer or operating engineer. And then at the end of their 4 years, they'll make $18 to $20 an hour at the beginning. No student debt, I might add. And we've got to deal with the student debt problem separately. We've got to do that. At the end of 4 or 5 years, they'll be making close to $40 an hour with benefits. And they were all wearing this T-shirt that said direct path to the middle class. We've got to learn how the Democratic Party's got to learn how to talk to workers. I talk often about the dignity of work. And I ask people along those lines to come to SherrodBrown.com and help us get that word out about the dignity of work. That regardless of whether you punch a badge or punch a clock or swipe a badge, whether you work in an office, whether you work for tips, you stand on the side of workers, you win elections, and you make the right decisions. I wear this canary pin. It's a depiction of a canary in a birdcage. The mine workers used to take a canary down in the mines. They had no union 100 years ago, strong enough, nor a government that cared enough to protect them. And I wear this because it reminds me to focus on workers, to focus on how do you help people join the middle class? And that's what we're doing in Ohio, and that's what we need to do around the country.
Senator Sherrod Brown, I'd love a canary pin next time I see you. I think that's a very powerful message. Thank you for so much for joining me tonight and for talking to me about such important issues going on in your state. I really appreciate it. Coming up next, the Great American Eclipse was just plain cool to most of us. I thought it was cool. But to others, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, there was something more sinister going on, apparently. I'll explain after this quick break. Today, millions of Americans across North America and the United States had the rare chance to watch a solar eclipse. The total solar eclipse, which has been nicknamed the Great American Eclipse for its long path over North America, was visible in 15 states. And there were varying views of a partial eclipse where they were enjoyed throughout the rest of the country, including by members of our team here in D.C. and in New York. Remember, it was only back in August of 2017 that the last solar eclipse cut across the United States. And just like today, Americans throughout the country paused their days to safely gaze at the sun through their protective shades, with, of course, the notable exception of this guy. In past millennia, solar eclipses used to be tied to mass superstition and fear a long time ago. But now they're instead rare moments of collective awe, where people get to watch an incredible and frankly very cool celestial event. But sometimes, even in this day and age, some folks try really hard to make it something more. Like on Friday, the day of the earthquake that rumbled parts of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene posted this, quote, "God is sending America strong signs to tell us to repent. Earthquakes and eclipses and many more things to come. I pray that our country listens." I mean, I'm just going to pause on that for statement for a moment because it's just, it's really something and you need to read it. Now, her post was, of course, quickly tagged with a community note that pointed out that the U.S. averages about 4 earthquakes a day. That's what happens. And that solar eclipses are able to be predicted well in advance. But have no fear. Congresswoman Greene doubled down on her post, writing, quote, "Many have mocked and scoffed at this." Correct. She noted, "Yes, eclipses are predictable and earthquakes happen. However, God created all of these things and uses them to be signs for those of us who believe." I mean, another explanation is sometimes these things are just coincidences. Maybe. I mean, but even Fox News attempted to not so subtly tie the eclipse to their favorite all-time political issue.
A Fox News alert, a rare celestial event collides with a policy failure on the ground. The southern border will be directly in the path of totality today when the moon covers the sun for nearly 4 minutes.
The funny thing is back in 2017, the last time there was a solar eclipse in the U.S., no serious person was trying to spin it this way. But in the larger context of the language that the right is pushing, 7 months out from Election Day, by the way, fear-mongering about invading migrants, unlivable cities, and Donald Trump warning about a bloodbath if he is not reelected, this is just another example of the fear that they are all too eager to inject into anything and everything under the sun. Coming up, an exciting announcement about something I've been working on for a very long time. It involves my new book and a big adventure on the road. We'll be right back. Before we go tonight, I've got some exciting news. My brand new book called Say More is coming out on May 7th, so you can pre-order it now. And tonight I can share that I'll hit the ground running that week on the Say More book tour. I'll be in New York City on May 8th, and I'll be visiting many cities and having conversations with some of my favorite people who you also probably know. I'll be sure to share all the information on the show's social media channels for anyone interested in attending. And I look forward to seeing you out there on the road and taking your questions too. That does it for me tonight. You can catch the show every Sunday at 12 p.m. and Monday at 8 p.m. on MSNBC. And don't forget to follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For now, goodbye from Washington, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.